Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Aaron Adams, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Think Like a Fish, Catch More Tarpon, Bonefish, and Permit. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Aaron Adams about Think Like a Fish. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts to continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers. The Federation needs it to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Aaron, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com. And look for the link under Aaron's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Aaron's latest book, The Orvis Guide to Fly Fishing for Coastal Gangfish, courtesy of Lions Press. And to find out more about what Lions Press has to offer, go to www.lionspress.com. That's LYONS press.com. So here's how you can win Aaron's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something Aaron and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. And so listen closely. Use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Aaron's book. Tonight our guest is Aaron Adams. And Aaron uses his fish research to formulate his fishing strategies and his fishing to help guide some of his research. He has a Ph.D. in environmental biology, a master's degree in marine science, holds a Coast Guard captain's license, has lived, worked, and fished in Maryland, North Carolina, California, Virginia, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Massachusetts, and Florida, and has conducted fish research throughout the Caribbean. He is a senior scientist at Moat Marine Laboratory and director of operations for the nonprofit Bonefish and Tarpon Trust. His pursuits of fisheries and habitat conservation are rooted in his years growing up near Chesapeake Bay, where he witnessed the collapse of the bay's habitats and fisheries. He is an avid fly angler, but manages to squeeze in some time to translate science and conservation into fishermen's terms. To that end, he authored three books and is a co-author on another. He has authored many magazine articles, has been part of TV shows applying fish science to fly fishing, is the publisher of two websites, fishermenscoast.com and tribalbonefish.com, and has given countless presentations to fishing clubs. After all, if anglers learn more about the fish they pursue, they will become better anglers and better stewards. Aaron, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks for having me on the show. Happy to be here.
Good, good. Well, I know we're competing with the presidential debate tonight, so hopefully everybody's got their recorder on and is taping that, or in this case, taping us. But either way, they'll both be taped, and hopefully we can revisit them later. Let's love to talk about, in going through your book, which is kind of what we're building the show on tonight, You've just got a ton of incredible information in there, and we're going to try to hit some high points of that tonight and teach our folks a little bit more about how to look for, find, and catch more of the coastal game fish that are out there. So, Aaron, let's start out. In your book, you start out saying that if a fly fisher understands the types of habitats, the types of prey, the ways game fish pursue their prey, and the way the game fish behave in and use their environments, that you become a better fly fisher, a more successful one. So can you go into more detail and tell us why you decided to delve into this and in your most recent book, The Orvis Guide to Fly Fishing for Coastal Game Fish?
Well, if you look at the world of freshwater fly fishing, say trout fishing, people have been writing about what it is that makes trout tick for eons, it seems. It's common to go to a trout stream and find somebody turning over a rock to see what kind of nymphs might be there, or have a small hand seine that they see what kind of bugs are in the water, or even trying to grab some flies out of the air to see what they should tie on. But in the saltwater world, that's never really been a part of the game for fly anglers. It's been more of asking around about what pattern works and throwing that pattern, but not necessarily knowing what it means. Or throwing a bait fish pattern in a situation where something like a shrimp or a crab on the bottom would work a lot better. And so seeing a lot of fellow anglers taking that approach, it seemed to me that there was a pretty big opening for sharing what I know about fish ecology in the marine world with other fly anglers so they could actually start approaching their fishing the same way that trout anglers, fly anglers have been doing for a long, long time. They basically try and share my knowledge and see if we can't get the fly anglers to kind of take the next step up in understanding the game fish they're fishing for and what those fish are eating. But perhaps more important in the longer term, if anglers are develop a better understanding of what it is they're fishing for and the habitats that the fish depend on, they're more likely to be better stewards. I mean, after all, Trout Unlimited, for example, has been around for a lot longer than any coastal fishing organization. And so in the marine world, we're trying to play catch up and both figuring the fish out and also making sure they're around for the future.
Right, right. Well, it seems to me, too, especially with, now, you live on the coast down there and have many locations, as we just alluded to in your introduction. But many of us, like I, live in the Rocky Mountains, and when I go down to the salt, it looks very intimidating. and of course, doesn't look like a trout stream or a lake. And with that, I think, you know, what you're going through in your book really kind of helps to sort that out. I think the other thing, too, is that when some of us come down there to fish, a lot of times we're with a guide, and, you know, we're taken to a spot, and they put on a fly and say, fish here, and you really don't know the whys and wherefores, and I think that's where your book comes into play, too.
Yeah, I think the same can be said for a salt fly angler like myself, who, you know, there's a lot of us who fish the salt who don't really fish trout waters very frequently, if at all. So it's the same type of challenge going the other way from salt to trout.
Sure.
First time I went trout fishing, I yanked the poor little guy out of the water. I up in upstate New York. And there's, you know, there's different casting techniques in fresh versus salt water. There's different ways to present the fly and those types of things. And, you know, again, until recently, and fortunately there's other authors who are taking the same approach, but until recently, you could find those kind of how-to books for freshwater, for trout fishing, but you really couldn't for saltwater.
Right.
So you were kind of at the mercy of your guide, or people who moved to the coast could join a fly fishing club and learn that way. And otherwise, it was just kind of trial and error.
Right,
And as you know, that can be awfully frustrating, especially when the water you're fishing is so big.
Right, exactly. Well,
it's kind of a bigger step than if you're used to fish in small streams in the Rockies, and then you go and fish large stillwater trout fisheries. You're going to the ocean, it's just another step up, but it's still a very different game than trout fishing.
Exactly. Yeah, totally different habitats, totally different type of water, plants, animals, all nine yards. Well, tonight we're going to be talking primarily about coastal, tropical, subtropical, and warm water fish habitats. Can you kind of describe to us the geographical area that like your book covers and what we'll be talking about tonight?
Sure. It's limited to, the examples are limited to, as far as tropics go, the Caribbean. And that will take you up into South Florida. And the subtropics are, say, South Florida through Central Florida. And then warm temperate goes from northern Florida up through, let's say, as far as Virginia. Mm-hmm. You could argue Chesapeake Bay is kind of warm temperate. Mm-hmm. But the approach I took in the book is I used all the habitats and the game fish from those regions as examples. But since the book is based on marine ecology, you can take all the information that's in the book and easily apply it to other marine realms. So you could, for example, use the chapter on salt marshes and apply it very easily to the salt marshes you fish in Cape Cod for striped bass. The same can be said for beaches. There's the techniques that, for example, that I use for sight fishing for snook along the beaches in Southwest Florida, you can take the same exact approach for sight fishing for striped bass along the beaches of you know, Cape Cod, Rhode Island, etc. So it's fish, you know, have a limited number of ways that they can interact with their environment, and so we can take some of that replication or redundancy, and so we can use it to apply the same techniques in a variety of locations and even with different species of game fish.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk in your book about life cycles of game fish. So why do we need to know more about their life cycles? How's that going to help us catch more fish?
A good example would be snook. I could pick any snook, redfish, tarpon, striped bass. From a fishing perspective, knowing the life cycles of the fish will tell you a lot about where you should look for them at different times of year, for example, or targeting different sizes or numbers of fish. For example, with snook, we know that they spawn along beaches or in inlets that connect oceans and estuaries during the summer. So if you want to, you know, let's say you're from the Rocky Mountain states and you're going to vacation in Florida, and you do so during the summer, your best shot at getting big snook is going to be along the beaches and in those inlets. Whereas if you go fishing those same locations during the winter, when the snook are not spawning, but are more likely to be back in the estuary, in the mangroves, or even up the rivers, then if you're on the beach, you might catch something else, but you're probably not going to catch any snook.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding that type of aspect from a fisherman's perspective is really important, because you know where to look for them. In the freshwater world, it'd be the same as knowing when and where largemouth bass spawn, so that you're not out looking for them hiding under stumps along a deep shoreline. Instead, you're looking for them in a shallow cove that's got some gravel or sand bottom where you'll find them spawning.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the conservation side of things, you know, it's really easy for us to focus on catching the big fish, you know, wanting that trophy, the biggest fish that, you know, we've sighted or can get to eat a fly. But it's really easy to forget that in order to get that trophy fish, you needed thousands of juvenile fish and tens of thousands of very small juvenile or or larval fish or eggs to get that big fish that supports the fishery. And so that's the stewardship side of things. As anglers, we need to understand where the big fish come from so that we can be sure to protect those areas to make sure we have big fish in the future. It's kind of like protecting streams for salmon, the headwaters of those streams. By the time a Pacific salmon gets up to the top of the streams, it's not really worth fishing for because they're starting to fall apart. But we know very well that if we don't protect those streams, we're not going to have juvenile salmon and we won't have a fishery in the future. So getting people to understand the life cycle of saltwater fish is twofold. One, to help them be in the right place at the right time. And then the other, to make sure they keep in mind that there's more to it than just fishing. We've got to take care of the fish that are out there in their habitat.
And each of the fish that we'll be talking tonight about has their own little special life cycle program going on as to where they drop their eggs, where their larva grows, and the fingerlings or whatever, and on to where they hang out as adults or migrate. So those are all going to be different. They aren't doing the same stages in the same places, I guess is what I'm trying to say. That's why
generally not.
Yeah.
I mean, another good example is our striped bass. You know, most people know that Chesapeake Bay is a major spawning area for striped bass. The Hudson River is as well. And their spawning mostly occurs during winter through early spring. And so those are important spawning habitats, so we need to protect them. But during certain times of year, they're also really good places to find some very large fish. Other times of year, Chesapeake Bay, for example, the fantastic fishery for striped bass, but in the summer they're mostly small fish that people call schoolies because they tend to school. They provide fantastic fishing, but it's going to be kind of fast action with smaller fish.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, depending on the type of fishing you want to do, you might plan a fishing trip to a certain place at a certain time of year. So, yeah, understanding all that stuff. Every fish is a little bit different.
Right.
And, yeah, that's part of the fun, though, fly fishing is figuring that out.
Right, doing that research. And I know we did a show recently with Robert Cunningham it's called Chasing Records, and I can't remember how many world records he's had on the fly and on spinning gear as well. But that was part of his research, is understanding these things and understanding that if you're going after a trophy, that trophies don't exist everywhere, even though the fish may exist everywhere. In other words, if just because tarpon exist in a certain area doesn't mean you're ever going to get a trophy there, because the bigger ones just don't hang out there. There are specific places they end up going. So I thought that was pretty interesting. He had to really do his research to make sure he was in the right place at the right time if he really wanted a trophy fish. Otherwise, he was wasting his time. So, and I guess understanding the habitat, too, goes into how a trophy fish is able to become a trophy fish as well, right?
Sure. And, you know, it's interesting, depending on the habitats that are available versus used to be available. There are some fisheries that you can still find those trophies. There are other fisheries where the trophies, unfortunately, really don't exist anymore. But, you know, knowing that kind of stuff as an angler, just like your previous guest knew, it gets you in the right place at the right time.
Right, right.
I mean, everybody's had the experience of being out in the water and spending a lot of time and not finding much of anything, and then talking to a buddy who was out the same day but somewhere else, and they had a fantastic day.
Right.
So figuring out where that 10% of the water is that has the fish on that day is a big part of the game.
Right. Well, Aaron, we need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll talk more about learning how fish think and where we can better find them. So, Hang tight. We'll be right back. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to ensure that everyone taking a trip leaves a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Aaron Adams about Think Like a Fish, how to catch more tarpon, bonefish, and permit. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Still speaking about life cycles, Aaron, tell us a bit about the life cycle of the prey and how that can help guide us to more fish.
It goes again to the interaction between the habitat and the fish. And the different times of year they're going to use those habitats because of their life cycle. We can use redfish as a good example. Most of the redfish that we fish for in coastal waters and estuaries are not mature. They're not sexually mature. Redfish, on average, will become sexually mature, say 30 to 36 inches. And so most of the redfish we're fishing for are that size or smaller, so they probably haven't even spawned yet. When they get mature, they, by and large, they'll move offshore into the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic Ocean. But they will come back in close to shore or even into the estuaries in the fall, maybe into the winter, because they come in the fall to spawn. So if we know about the life cycle of redfish, and we know that they use different habitats at different life stages, that we can use that to target specific sizes of redfish. If you want to catch a monster redfish, for example, your best time to do that is going to be in the fall inshore. Whereas if you go into the spring or early summer for redfish, you'll probably catch some nice ones in the estuaries, but not necessarily a really big one. There's exceptions to that general rule, of course, but in general, you can find similar patterns with other species of fish. Tarpon's another good example. You know, pushing, it's worthwhile, pushing into the backcountry, say, of the Everglades, because you're not necessarily going to catch really large tarpon overall, but you know what the requirements are for the juvenile or subadult tarpon, what we call baby tarpon, anywhere from, say, 5 to 50 pounds, you can have some fantastic fishing, catching many, many fish a day. But you have to understand what their habitat requirements are for that life stage before you can find them.
Right. Well, what I had asked about is the life cycle of the prey. In other words...
I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought you were talking about the game fish.
Yeah.
Prey follow the similar life cycle patterns as do the game fish. Blue crabs, for example, are going to likely be of smaller sizes during the summer when their larvae first come into the estuary and then grow throughout the summer into the fall. So changing the sizes of your flies to reflect that can be very beneficial. Similar fashion, grass shrimp can be a really important prey item for a lot of fish, everything from striped bass and weakfish up north to spotted sea trout down south. And their greatest abundance is going to be in the late winter, early spring. And so if you know those types of things, then you know which flies to tie on first. The small shrimp flies, something like epoxy shrimp, is really good in the spring, for example, when the striped bass first show up in the estuaries up north. And that's a very good shrimp pattern, even down here in Florida in the spring when the trout are really on that. But later in the year, that's not going to be the case because the grass shrimp aren't nearly as abundant. Seems like, well, like things can be set.
There's a particular kind of worm or something that the tarpon are fond of, right?
The Palolo worm is a really big on certain moons in the Keys in the late spring into the summer. And there's a similar phenomenon up in New England with striped bass and some of the coastal lagoon ponds on the full moons, sometimes the new moons in the late spring into early summer as well. And then, of course, there's the bait fish. Mullet generally spawn in the winter, early spring. And so there's juvenile mullet. People also often call them finger mullet. They're pretty common in the estuaries, starting in the late summer into fall. And there can be some pretty amazing feeding frenzies on those juvenile mullet as they come out of the estuaries in the fall, say out of the Carolinas estuaries, and move southward migration. So there's a ton of examples of those types of seasonal differences in prey abundance that are the result of those prey life cycles, which in many ways mirror the game fish life cycles. Figuring those out is key to not only being in the right place at the right time, but knowing what fly to tie on so you're prepared.
Right. Now, will some of those, like the worm hatch or any of the examples you gave, can those be, at times, can they draw in larger trophy fish? In other words, if you study those prey and when those cycles happen, is that a time that you can expect larger fish to come in or not?
Yeah, it certainly can be the case. It's frequently more fish and often larger fish. Yeah, larger fish as well. That's true for the tarpon to some extent. The fall run of menhaden and mullet out of the estuaries in the northern Gulf of Mexico brings in some monster redfish. Striped bass up in New England that tend to feed on the worms, they're often rather large as well. So not just numbers, but yes, frequently size of fish as well.
Right, yeah, because I know we have, you have a similar situation many times with trout fishing where a hatch comes on and some of the larger fish, which are normally pretty solitary and hang out in protected areas will come out because, they just lose all fear because there's so much food there they just can't stand it, And that's why it's kind of asking about salt too. Let's talk about tides for a few minutes and maybe give us a brief lesson on tides and how, why we need to know about tides and how they affect the way we're going to find fish.
Well, tides are caused by are influenced mostly by the moon and somewhat by the sun. As the moon moves, it creates, there's a bit of a gravitational force associated with the moon, and so it actually kind of creates a bulge of water on the side of the earth that the moon is on. And because things have to stay balanced, then that creates a bulge on the opposite side of the earth of water, bulge of water on the opposite side of the earth. And so then in between, there's a little bit less water, a little bit of a trough, so to speak, in a wave to compensate for that water that's bulging on the other sides. When the moon and the sun are aligned, either as a full moon or a new moon, the additional gravitational force from the sun helps to make those bulges associated with the moon's pull even larger. And so basically you have bulges of water moving around the earth, and that as they move, that's what creates our high and low tides. Because there's additional pull when the sun and the moon are aligned, that creates higher than normal high tides and lower than normal low tides. Those are called spring tides. The quarter moons, when the moon and the sun are at right angles in relation to the earth, those are called neap tides. And that's when the bulges are the smallest, which means that the troughs between them aren't as deep, which means that the high and low tides aren't very different from one another. And tides are, what causes tides? guides and how they interact with land and whatnot is pretty complex, but difficult to describe verbally in a couple minutes. But
yeah,
I think the key thing is for people to who are interested in saltwater fly fishing to actually spend some time doing some research on tides so that they understand at least the basics. Because you can, in general, predict what the tides might be, or at least the tidal range, based on what the moon phase is and the time of year. And so even if you're in a place, say areas in the Bahamas, where there might not be tide charts, you ought to have a good idea, based on the lunar cycle, whether the tides are going to be extra high and extra low with a lot of current moving, or they're not going to be so different, so there's not going to be much current, because all that will affect fishing. You know, in general, I'd say a lot of saltwater anglers like tides that create some current, because current tends to get fish moving, it gets prey moving as well. But at the same time, if you are experiencing some pretty extreme high and low tides, that can make fishing pretty difficult. One example is with bonefish. If you have if you're fishing for bonefish at a spring tide, so you have very high tides and very low tides, on those high tides, you have so much of the coastal flat, the mangrove flat, flooded that there's an almost limitless amount of area that you have to cover to find the bonefish. They can be literally just about anywhere. Whereas if you have a less extreme tide, there's not as much coastal flats that are flooded, and so the range of the bonefish is going to be limited. You're more likely to find them.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side of that, if you have extremely low tide, that'll probably push the bonefish off the flats entirely, which may put them into deeper water, which makes them a lot tougher to see and to fish for. So how the fish react to tides depends a lot on how strong the tides are and what the tidal range is, whether it's a foot or 6 feet. And that changes through the month as the lunar phase changes. So that adds another layer of complexity to figuring out where to be and when to be there. I mean, you mentioned earlier coming from the Rockies and fishing the ocean, it could be kind of intimidating. And I found that the tides are probably the number one factor that really mess up freshwater anglers. So a good first step before you go fishing in the salt is to do some research, do some reading on how tides work, how the moon phase affects them, and then figure out what the tide cycle is, where you're going to fish. And in general, fishing moving water is probably better than fishing water that's not moving, say when the dead low or dead high tide. And so if you've got limited time, focusing on moving water is probably best.
Mm-hmm.
The second I would say is, if you have to make a choice between fishing around low tide or fishing around high tide, I typically choose fishing around low tide, simply for the reason that there are fewer places you have to search for the fish, because there are some places that just don't have enough water in them. So it just reduces your search area, which makes life a lot easier.
Aaron, I'm going to ask you, can you unplug your headset and give this a try without your headset? Because you're breaking up a lot, and I just want to see if that's going to help here.
Sure. Let's try this.
Okay.
Any better?
Yeah, I think it is. Let's give that a try. The study of that and just where fish are, I can see how that really makes a difference. There are times for particular fisheries where it's going to be very difficult to find fish and or fish for the fish just based upon the tide alone. And so I can definitely see how that plays a big role in your success, you know, of finding and catching fish.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, when I'm fishing in my home waters, and there's days where we have an especially high tide, a lot of times I'll just kind of take a break for a couple hours. You know, because you can still find fish, but the number of fish for the amount of effort typically isn't the best.
Right, so, right. Well, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, let's talk about some of the different kinds of areas that we might fish. Like, let's talk about seagrass first. So I'll be right back, and we'll do just that. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. Again, that's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or you can call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Aaron Adams about Think Like a Fish. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Aaron, let's talk for a few minutes about seagrass. There's a lot of different habitats that we can talk about, seagrass, mangroves, oyster bars, salt marshes, beaches, all kinds of things. And we certainly don't have time to cover all these in depth, but maybe you can kind of give us an idea about each one of these as we go through it, and an overview and maybe some examples of how we might deal with this. So, first of all, there are many types of seagrass, right?
Yeah, many types of seagrass. If you're going to be fishing in the tropics or subtropics, you'll come across turtle grass, shoal grass, widgeon grass, manatee grass, and a couple other species that you probably won't come across but are there. And if you're farther north in the temperate, warm temperate areas, it's pretty much just one species of grass, eelgrass. But from a fisherman's perspective, the reason I teach people about all the different species of seagrass is that each of those species of seagrass has a specific ecological requirement. And so you can use that to get an idea of things like what is the typical tidal range here, and is it close to low tide or high tide, even where to look for fish. So let's take, for example, something like turtle grass, which is probably the most common seagrass in the tropics and subtropics, and even up into portions of the northern Gulf of Mexico. Turtle grass really can't handle things like wave energy. It can handle some current, but not too much. It needs to have its roots covered by water most, if not all, of the time. So if you see turtle grass, you know it's an area that doesn't get a lot of wave action, has moderate current at best, and only on rare occasions will a low tide, you know, expose the roots of that seagrass. In contrast, you have something like shoal grass, which can handle a little bit of the wave action, can handle being exposed to air for a longer period. And so it's a good indicator of a place that either has more energy or gets shallower more often. So one example of how that applies to fishermen is if you're looking on a grass flat for tailing redfish, say it's low tide, and you're going to fish that incoming tide for redfish, the place to start looking for them is the area where the grass transitions from turtle grass, which requires slightly deeper water, to shoal grass, which can handle shallower water. And more often than not, you'll find the redfish start to tail, to feed and tail right along that edge. And the differences in depth, water depth I'm talking about, aren't you know, by feet. It's by a couple of inches. And the fish, you know, they inherently know this. It's kind of like a trout knowing exactly where to sit behind a rock in the stream to get the maximum benefit of the, you know, the currents that swirl around that rock. Redfish and trout and other fish know exactly where these transition zones are, so that they have to move off the flat to get out of the area that's going to dry up where the shoal grass is, but they don't have to move especially far. Once they get into that turtle grass, they can kind of stop and hang out and wait for the tide to turn around and then start working their way back onto the flat.
Kind of like a safety zone there that they know it's not going to get completely dry in.
And then it's a similar thing with farther north, say in Chesapeake Bay with eelgrass. The eelgrass is a pretty good indicator of where the fish are going to be, because the grass also provides a lot of shelter for prey, which is what the fish are there looking for.
Now, what kind of are there particular species of fish that we'll find more often than not in the grass beds?
On the grass beds, if you're in the tropics, bonefish for sure, permit as well, a lot of different species of jacks as well as barracuda, like grass beds because there's a lot of things there for them to eat. And even tarpon a lot of times will feed over grass beds or hang out, lay up over grass beds. And as you move farther north, redfish, spotted sea trout, snook to some extent, but they're more associated with mangroves and that type of thing. And then, of course, farther north, weakfish and striped bass also will move in and out of grass beds as they search for prey.
Now, are there particular kinds of prey that prefer grass beds over mangroves, for instance?
I would say the dominant, I mean, there's a lot of overlap, of course, but common prey in the grass beds are going to be shrimp, many species of small fish like pinfish, even small mojarras, which are small silver, kind of oval-shaped fish. Some species of bait fish are going to be there, but primarily the bait fish will be in more open water. So typically when I fish grass beds, I'll pick out shrimp flies, maybe some crab flies because there's a lot of mud crabs that are in the grass bed, and then some swimming crabs as well, like blue crabs. And those are going to be my go-to flies in the grass bed.
Okay.
Those are the most common prey.
Okay. Well, let's talk about mangroves. And again, there's not just one type of mangrove. There's several, and can you kind of brief us on the different kinds? And also, the location of the mangroves makes a difference too, doesn't it?
Yes, you can use the ecological requirements of mangroves, very similar to what I described for seagrass, and figure out a lot about the area, the water depth, tide levels, and where you might find the fish. So probably the easiest one to start with is a black mangrove. Black mangroves are good indicators of your typical high tide line. Black mangroves, the trunk goes into the ground, but because the sediment, the ground in marshes, typically doesn't have any oxygen. It can't send roots into the ground like a tree can on land and obtain oxygen for the root system. So instead, black mangroves send these little pencil-shaped roots out of the ground into the air. And those pencil-shaped roots called nematophores have thousands of tiny little pores in them that allow gas exchange, and that way they can get oxygen to the plant. But those roots, those little pencil roots, have to be exposed to air for at least part of the tidal cycle. They can't be underwater all the time. And so that's why they tell you where your typical high tide line is, because they have to be exposed at low tide. And so that's a fantastic place to look for things like redfish and snook, because all those little fish and shrimp and crabs that hide up in those little pencil roots during high tide have to leave as the tide drops. And typically, adjacent to black mangroves is just open mud or sand. And so all those little fish and crabs are pretty well exposed. So you can get some pretty good feeding action from redfish and snook along those shorelines, and even bonefish. But the most dominant type of mangrove is a red mangrove. And what they do, instead of having the trunk go into the ground and the pencil roots come out of the ground, is they have what are called prop roots. It's kind of like having a tree root system above the ground. And those roots hold the plant above the water, and the roots anchor the plant to the ground. And just like the black mangrove roots, the red mangrove roots have thousands of tiny pores in them that allow oxygen exchange. But that means that those roots have to be exposed to air for part of the tide cycle. And so you can look at the red mangrove roots and see where they consistently get wet and where they're typically dry. And that'll give you a good idea of water levels and whether the tide is high or low. The nice thing about red mangroves is that root system provides a lot of really good habitat for game fish prey. All kinds of small fish, crabs, shrimp, worms, the list goes on, hide among those red mangrove roots. And so you'll get everything from snook to tarpon to bonefish to redfish cruising the edges of those mangroves or even weaving among the submerged prop roots searching for prey. So again, those are fantastic places to fish. And knowing about those plants and the fact that they need some exposure to air for the roots, etc., can give you a good idea of places to look for fish. As an example, with the red mangroves, if the water level is all the way up, it's covering all of the mangrove roots, and it's even up touching the leaves of the mangroves, then you know it's especially high tide, and that if there are fish around, they're probably going to be way up under the mangroves, so it's not the best time for fishing. Mm-hmm. You might want to go try fishing somewhere else, but if the water level is a good bit below the leaves of the tree and a lot of the roots are exposed, then a lot of those game fish and the prey that they're pursuing probably had to leave the mangrove, protection of the mangrove roots because of that dropping tide. And so you're more likely to find fish along the edges of the mangrove, something that you can actually sight fish for.
Well, don't you also have, like you said, you know, at particular times you're going to have these different tidal occurrences and so forth. And I know down in the Keys sometimes it means maybe just going to another island or through a gap or something to find a fishery that's more suitable because of the tide, because it's also based upon the kind of the topography of the area and so forth is on the sea bottom, right?
The Keys to some extent are unique in that the water, the tide as it moves, has to move through the Keys, which act like a baffle. They kind of restrict the flow of the water, so there's a delay. And so, yeah, you can have a high tide on the ocean side of the Keys and move to the Florida Bay side of the Keys and be much closer to low tide. So you can definitely take advantage of that topography to be in that place closer to low tide. It's definitely an awesome strategy. And you can do the same type of thing with in some islands like the Bahamas. Some of the islands, one side of the island to the north side, might be a full 3 hours different in the tidal cycle than the south side, because it takes that long for the water to work its way around the island. Or even within an estuary, if you have an estuary that's, say, 15 miles long or so, you might have a 2+ hour difference in the tide from the mouth of the estuary to the top of the estuary.
Right.
So you can definitely move around to find the best areas. And something else to remember, too, is that tides are very important, but wind can, depending on where you are, can negate the tide. Gulf of Mexico is famous for that because the tide range is typically only a foot or two. And so if you get a strong offshore wind, which often happens with cold fronts in the winter, the low tide will be extra low, and the high tide on some days, on the worst days, might not ever happen because so much water's been pushed offshore by that wind. And that can happen even in places like Cape Cod. They have a 6-foot tide range. The tide won't be stopped, but say an incoming tide can be delayed by a strong offshore wind by say half an hour or so. And somehow the fish know this. Even though they don't have a meteorologist, they know this. And so they take advantage of it.
Right.
So understanding that type of stuff, interaction between habitats and tide, again, can help you narrow the list of locations to be find the best fishing.
Aaron, we got a question in on the internet here. Treg in Moscow, Idaho, asks, the larger fish that may be available during spawning time, do you recommend not fishing during the spawn?
You know, it really depends on the species of fish. There's been some research done, for example, on snook in Florida, where they actually experimentally fished for snook that were in spawning mode and tagged them and then let them go and observed if they went back into the school that was spawning and participated in spawning, and they did. So it didn't seem to affect snook, even if they appeared to be in that mode of actually participating in spawning. For other fish, it might be more of an issue. But in the saltwater world, it's actually pretty rare for people to fish for actual spawning fish. It's not like, say, if you're fishing for largemouth bass and you can see them on the beds, and if you pull them off the beds and they can't protect the eggs or the fry. Typically, ocean fish and all of the game fish that we fish for spawn a little bit differently. They get together in large groups, typically, in open water of some sort, and they do what's called broadcast spawning. They eject the eggs and sperm into the open water by the thousands or even millions. And the fertilization is external, and then the eggs float off on the currents and hatch, and then what we call larvae comes out, and they float around in the open ocean for days to weeks to even months, depending on the species. So it's not like they're protecting nests. It's a little bit different game than you might be used to for trout or for bass.
Right. We've got another question here from Rob Millers in Mexico City. And he says, I'm interested in targeting snook on the fly, but particularly Mexican snook. And he's got the Latin name for it, Centropomys oii, something like that. And he says he's been trying to research the different variations of snook, and IGFA lists something like 11 species, but he's having trouble finding information. He wanted to know if you could recommend any fish biology publications or websites that would help him to identify the different snook species from one another.
Well, that's a tough one, because a lot of scientists are trying to figure out a lot of that stuff, too. It's tough. I mean, a lot of some of the more recent stuff on snook, they've turned to genetics to figure some of it out. And that's just in the Caribbean. And then on the Pacific coast, of Central America, you have another species or two of snook as well. As far as resources to check them out, you might want to try the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Often has good resources on that, or the Smithsonian Institution. And then the third one would be FishBase, F-I-S-H-B-A-S-E, FishBase.org. It's a kind of an international information clearinghouse for fish information. Mm-hmm. So those would be my three recommendations. But
okay.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. I know we just did a show on the Colorado greenback cutthroat trout, and they're going to genetics, and even genetics isn't telling them everything because there's been some, you know, crossbreeding and so forth. So I guess it gets really tough. We need to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more and dig into some oyster bars, salt marshes, and beaches and see what those have to offer us. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or visit his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Aaron Adams about Think Like a Fish. If you'd like to ask Aaron a question, just go to our homepage and ask about fly fishing and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Aaron, we did have another question here that came in on the Internet, Jerry Davis in Helena, Montana. And he said, people probably only fish the areas he goes to in the salt once or twice, and they will always use a guide and assume that they have the knowledge of the tides, life cycles, fish, and so forth. So what things should he know, or maybe also what things should he ask of a guide to make sure that he gets the most out of these trips in relation to what we're talking about tonight?
Sure. Well, slightly off topic, but the first thing I'd say is, for his own sake and for the guide's sake, is for him to practice his casting. We talked a little bit before about the difference between fishing for trout or fishing in the salt, and the biggest challenge is being able to cast efficiently, quickly, and for some distance. And that'll open up a lot more opportunities for him. But the other thing that he might want to do is, when he starts the day with the guide, is just ask the guide, you know, what his thoughts on the general strategy are for the day. You know, with the weather the way it is and the tides the way they are, what's going to be the best bet? A lot of times, and we all do it, we'll say, okay, I'm going to go to the Florida Keys because I want to catch a tarpon. But it might be that the conditions are poor for sight fishing for tarpon. Maybe it's cloudy and windy, and so chances of sighting a tarpon if you're sight fishing are going to be pretty slim. But if you went back instead into the mangroves and cast the mangrove shorelines, you might catch some snook and redfish and maybe some baby tarpon. So I would suggest the first thing to do is to educate himself a bit on what it is he's fishing for, different species and some of their habitats, and then start the day with a conversation with the guide of what he wants to fish for and what the strategy is, and then why, just so that he can understand what's going on.
Okay, good tips. Well, let's talk about oyster bars a little bit. First of all, what are oyster bars, and how are they formed? And where will we find them most often?
You won't find oysters in the Rocky Mountains, that's for sure.
Will.
Not these kind of oysters.
Rocky Mountain oysters, we've got those.
Oysters are saltwater, we call them bivalves, two shells. Clam is another type of bivalve. And they generally attach to different species of oysters, but they generally attach to something. Some attach to mangrove prop roots or dock pilings. But what we typically fish for the typical habitats that we fish on as far as oysters go are oyster bars. And those types of oysters kind of attach to hard bottom or even to themselves. And over time, they build up reefs or bars, depending on what terminology you want to use. Oysters are all different shapes, and they don't fit together neatly, so there's all kinds of nooks and crannies in between them. And those provide habitat for crabs and shrimp are probably at the top of the list, but then also some smaller species of fish. In oyster bars, the way they survive, the way oysters survive is they filter feed. They filter materials out of the water. And so that means they always need a fresh supply of water coming through, bringing them things to eat, different types of plankton, those types of things. And so oyster bars are good indicators of areas that receive good tidal flow, or at the mouth of rivers, good river flow. There's going to be some kind of current there bringing them fresh food. So if you find oyster bars, you know you're in a spot that's got good current movement, which means that the water's always being refreshed, which typically means more things for fish to eat. And so good places to look for your game fish.
Are they kind of like a canary in the coal mine, too, as far as water quality goes?
Yeah, they certainly can be considered that. Chesapeake Bay is a good example of a place that doesn't have many oysters anymore. And it is partly due to over-harvest, partly due to poor water quality and disease, but the lack of oysters in the bay has caused a decline in the water quality, and that has had a kind of, a cascading effect on everything else as well. They're definitely, if you have oysters, you typically have decent water quality, which then is reflected in more things for fish to eat, and so more fish for us to catch.
Sure. What kind of game fish, how far south will oysters get? Are they in the tropics?
Well, you have oysters. You do have oysters in the tropics, but you don't have oyster bars.
Okay.
Oyster bars are going to be found from in the regions we're talking about, in the subtropical and warm temperate region.
Okay.
In the subtropical regions, the oyster bars are frequently underwater at high tide and exposed somewhat at low tide. You go farther north where you get freezes in the winter, and the oyster bars are mostly just entirely submerged. In the tropics, you have oysters for sure, but they're typically attached to the prop roots of the red mangroves.
Okay.
But in all cases, they provide a pretty complex habitat that is really good for holding prey for game fish.
And the ones in the warmer waters, warm water in the subtropic areas, what kind of game fish are usually will we find hanging out about around these bars?
Well, in the tropics, the oysters along the mangrove shorelines and the prop roots, it's primarily game fish and some snappers. You can get some pretty large snappers, for example, down in Central America along those mangrove shorelines that have a lot of oysters hanging on them. In Florida, mostly redfish and somewhat spotted sea trout. In the Carolinas, redfish, geez, even striped bass, bluefish, sea trout, a whole full collection of game fish. I'll hang around oyster bars at some point in the year.
Okay. Now, let's, we're running out of time, so I've got to move quick here, but I still want to cover salt marshes and beaches here. So tell us briefly about salt marshes and what we might find there and how we might fish those.
Well, salt marshes are a great transition between the land and the sea, and they typically occur in places that have what you might call a gentle sloping topography, so you won't find them in places that have really steep drop-offs. And they do a pretty good job of filtering what comes out of the off the land and streams or whatnot, or runoff into the ocean and into the estuary. And so they're usually pretty nutrient-rich environments, which means that they have a lot of prey in them. Fiddler crabs are really abundant in salt marshes. You get a whole community of small fishes that move in and out of the marsh as the tide comes in and out. And so they're really attractive places to get for game fish because they're protected from wave energy, so relatively calm waters, and then they provide just a lot of food back in those protected areas. So there's a couple different strategies for fishing them. In places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, my favorite way to fish the salt marshes is you get a low tide, and as the tide starts to come into the marsh, you'll have a red drum follow that water into the marsh, coming up through the marsh grass, feeding on fiddler crab. So you can actually wade among the marsh grass looking for redfish pushing up into that. It's kind of like if you imagine a fish swimming through a lawn that has, somebody's front lawn that has grass that's 4 feet tall. it's pretty spectacular fishing. Another way to fish them is once the water's way up in the marsh and the tide drops, all those fish and some of the crabs that were up among that marsh grass get washed out into the creeks that drain the marsh. And so you'll get a lot of fish. Redfish is one of them, striped bass, bluefish, spotted sea trout. They'll hang out in those creeks waiting for stuff to be swept off the marsh to them. So they can be fantastic times to, falling tide is a fantastic time to fish those creeks as well.
So again, the tide becomes a big player in this whole game. Understand
tide is always a major factor. Always. Yeah. Always. Yeah. It's all.
Well, one last thing, and I know we're kind of rushing through this, but if people want to learn more about this, they'll have to just get your book. because there's a lot to it, as we're discovering. But let's just touch upon beaches, because that, to me, I look at a beach and think, gosh, that looks like a desert to me, but it really isn't, is it?
No, beaches are a lot more complex than you might think. My suggestion for somebody who wants to fish a beach is to figure out, and we're going to say this word again, figure out when the low tide is, when most of the beach is exposed, and even if you don't fish, just take a walk along the beach, and you'll notice that the beach isn't really just long and straight, but that there's hills and swales that reflect the currents and the wave movements. There's often what we call a longshore bar. It's a sandbar that runs parallel to shore. That can be anywhere from a few feet to 50 yards offshore. And then between that sandbar and shore, there's typically a trough. There's often cuts in that bar that allow water to get out, water from that trough to escape back out into the ocean. There's a lot of complexity along sandy beaches. And that complexity is affected by tide. It's also affected by the amount of waves that the beach receives. So you might get some areas, say, along the southwest coast of Florida, a lot of Caribbean beaches that don't get a lot of wave action. So they're very gently sloped, the kind of beaches where you can walk offshore a couple hundred yards and still only be like thigh deep or waist deep. Believe it or not, a lot of times you'll find fish, game fish, swimming right along the water's edge on those kinds of beaches. It's almost like fishing a flat. bonefish, snook, tarpon even. There's even up in New England, some of those kind of beaches, you get striped bass doing that same type of thing, swimming right along the water's edge. And then you'll get beaches that get a lot of wave energy, like you might get on the Atlantic coast of Florida. And there tends to be a steeper drop-off closer to shore. And it may be harder to find the fish because of the deeper water, but they'll often be right up against the shoreline as well. But if they're not up against the shoreline, on those types of higher energy beaches, you also often will find small rips, rip currents, which is basically waves pushing water up on the beach, and that water kind of collecting in one particular area before it rushes off the beach. And you can identify those areas by them being kind of murky water in the midst of otherwise clean water as sediments taken off the beach. But those areas with that extra current often attract game fish because they're looking for prey, other small fishes, to be disoriented by those different currents, and they just wait for them and pick them off.
So you have small fish there, as well as you have crab and shrimp in these areas as well? Or?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You get many species of crabs, many species of, not so many, but a decent number of species of shrimp, and a lot of different species of fish, other bait fish. And so the point of all that is that if you look at a beach and you look for the differences between one form and another, say a little drop-off or change in water color, those indicate habitat changes along the beach, which will help to concentrate prey, whether it's crabs or fish, and then that attracts the game fish as well.
We've got, we're going to finish up with you talking about stewardship and the Bonefish Tarpon Trust, which you're very much involved with, but I've got about four questions I want you to kind of knock off here real quick, and some of them might be too general for you, but these are questions that people wrote in about, and weren't on any particular topic we've talked about. But let's just kind of run through them and see if you can give them your best answer here, Ryan. Chris in Central Florida asks, are there genetic bonefish differences between bonefish and tarpon of the Atlantic Gulf, of the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico that live in the Pacific?
Yes, there are two species of tarpon, one in the Atlantic and one in the Pacific. The one in the Pacific is considerably smaller, doesn't get nearly as big as the one we have in the Atlantic. For bonefish, worldwide, they were genetically identified, I think, 11 or 12 different species. There are four different species in the Caribbean, and two of them might be caught by an angler, but similar to what you talked about for the trout, an angler could have these two different species and one in each hand and not tell the difference. We've got to use genetics to tell that difference.
Okay, another question. Thatcher in Spokane, Washington, said he's read an experience that permit are either in a feeding mood or they're not. When does fly selection really matter? And, like when they're in the mood or not. Bottom line, as long as you use crab or shrimp patterns, to what degree does fly selection make a difference in getting permit to eat? And I know you talked about this a bit in your book, about they just aren't always in the mood, right?
Oh, sure. That's true with any fish species. I mean, Lefty Cray said one time to me after a tough day of bone fishing, he said, I don't understand why fishermen think that fish always are hungry. So you can have any species of fish that kind of just turns off and is not going to eat. Permit are notoriously picky for that. But, yeah, fly selection does matter, both because of location and, as in, say, Belize versus the Keys, and then the type of habitat that you're fishing, and then the conditions. But probably more important is how you present the fly. Fly is definitely important. How you present the fly is really important.
Okay.
And crab and shrimp for sure. But I caught, depending on the habitat, I caught permit on urchin flies.
Again, do your homework, right?
Yeah, for sure. Do your homework.
Gilbert in the Netherlands asks if flats are not smooth and there's still warm wind blowing that creates small waves. How do you see or find the bonefish?
Practice. A lot of it is image recognition. Your brain sees them before your eyes see them before your brain tells you that you see them. And that image is just a little bit different when it's wavy. But the thing too is to if you can figure out a way to get the sun behind you in such a way that you are looking into the sides of those small waves on the flat. That can actually, those sides of the waves can give you a prism to look through to actually see the fish, or salt at the bottom where you might see the fish. But practice is the biggest one.
Go out without a pole and just look. I know that's what a lot of guides will tell you.
Some of the best fishing. Right. Some of the best advice I heard for a guy who was wanted to become a guide in the Keys was another guide told him, you know, get yourself a bucket of chicken and go anchor your boat on a flat. And just sit there all day and watch. Eat the chicken so you don't go hungry and just watch.
There you go. Okay, one last question. Tom in Fort Worth, Texas. He says, we're traveling to Smyrna Beach last part of October to fish the famous Mosquito Lagoon in Florida. Mid-October is supposed to be the very best time of year. We're hearing the fish are running back up into the lagoon depending on the tide. Do you have any tips, what to throw, what to look for, whatever? Are you familiar with that fishery?
Yeah, it can be pretty good. Talking about New Smyrna Beach and the inlet there, fish coming back in on the rising tide. If you're lucky, I'll come across some schools of bait that are getting chased by, geez, everything from tarpon to cobia to jacks, snook. And if you see that kind of bait fish action, my suggestion is to put on a popper or a surface fly like a gurgler, just because it can be so exciting when the fish hit it. But they probably start with bait fish patterns, deceivers, buzzers, especially in those areas. And then if he turns to start trying to fish for redfish up in the seagrass beds, he'll want to go to shrimp patterns. But I'd start with a collection of bait fish patterns first and just look for some action.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, to finish up, I know you're very concerned and involved with stewardship of our fisheries and fish, and you being on staff with Bonefish Tarpon Trust, even take a bigger role with this. So can you kind of educate us on this, how we might become better stewards of our fisheries, and also how the Bonefish Tarpon Trust plays a role in all this?
Well, the Bonefish Tarpon Trust is a science-based conservation organization. So what we do is we determine the status of scientific knowledge about bonefish tarpon and permit and determine what the major threats are to those fisheries. And then we fund research to fill in those knowledge gaps and figure out how the fishery can respond to different threats like habitat loss. And then we work on, you know, conservation actions like habitat restoration or different protections or things like that to make sure that the fishery is around in another 20, 30, 40 years. Or in places that have had a declined fishery to try and restore that fishery to what it was. And a lot of that work has to do with understanding how bonefish tarpon and permit use different habitats or what habitats they require. Because since these fish are pretty much recreational fish only and mostly catch and release, over-harvest isn't a problem like it is with some fisheries. The primary threats comes from habitat loss and habitat degradation. And so that's where we're putting a lot of our effort. And that's a major factor, I think, for just about any fishery. I would think that just about everyone listening has some experience with a degradation or loss of habitat and a negative impact on on something that they fish for. And so that's probably our biggest challenge for bonefish, tarpon, and permit, but also for a lot of other fish species that are out there. I know, for example, that Trout Unlimited does a lot of habitat work, Federation of Fly Fishers as well, Coastal Conservation Association. So it's a pretty big challenge. And, you know, it's interesting, the National Wildlife Federation just came out with a poll that they took of hunters and anglers, and among the top priorities that they listed was habitat conservation and protection. So there's definitely that realization among the anglers and hunters. Unfortunately, that realization, by and large, has not translated into those anglers being involved in conservation. So they realize it's a problem, but they're not necessarily involved. So my biggest request to anglers out there that are listening is to get involved. Bonefish Tarpon Trust, of course, is special to me because of my involvement with it. But there's a lot of other organizations that they could become involved with to make sure that we get our act together regarding the habitat. Because the less habitat we have, the fewer opportunities we have to fish. And once the habitat's gone, it's tough, if not impossible, to get it back.
Right, right. Well, I know the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, as well as other national and international organizations, like you mentioned, Trout Unlimited, Federation of Fly Fishers, are all organizations that may have a local chapter by you that you can get involved with, and a lot of them do the stream restorations, and beach cleanups,
right,
all that kind of stuff where you can, you don't need to know, you don't have to be a scientist to help out, and I think that's where we can all kind of lend a hand.
Correct. Chico Fernandez, who's one of the best bonefish anglers that I know, he said it best. He said, you know, when I was younger, I could just kind of go fishing and have a great time and forget about it until the next time I went. But now he realizes that if he wants that fishery to be around for his son and grandson, that he can't just go fishing and go home. He's got to become involved in becoming a responsible steward to make sure that that sticks around.
Right, right. Good way to finish things up here. We're out of time, so we need to kind of close things off here and take care of some final business here. But, Aaron, stick with me here because we're going to be giving away your book and going to ask a question of the audience and have them answer, and whoever gets it right is going to win your book. So hang tight here with me. I've got a few more things to take care of before we close things up. We're also going to be giving away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So stay with us here a few more minutes. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet, some of the best trophy trout, rainbow trout, and fly fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org to learn more about how you can get involved. That's www.savebristolbay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that said, "What did you think of the show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's a time to give away our prizes, and the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on some of these incredible prizes we give away. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you by email and provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. Okay, so first thing we're giving away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and if you want to learn more about the Federation, go to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. And do our search in our database. And our winner is Megan Carfagno. Agnew, and Megan's in Arkansas. So congratulations, Megan. And if you do have a membership to the FFF, we will get that extended for you as well. So congratulations. Now for our second drawing, it's going to be for Fly Fusion Magazine. If you want to learn more about Fly Fusion Magazine, go to www.flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Great instructional magazine with beautiful photographs. I know you'll enjoy it. And let's see here. Our winner for that is Russ Stevenson. Russ Stevenson in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Russ, on winning that subscription. Okay, now our grand prize for the evening here is, of course, Aaron Adams' book, The Orvis Guide to Fly Fishing for Coastal Gamefish. And, you know, we just really touched the surface of what this book contains today. And if you're going to be fishing for any of these coastal gamefish, you're going to want to get a copy. And we're giving away this book tonight courtesy of Lions Press. And that's www.lionspress.com. And you can see what other books they have to offer in the way of fly fishing. And this is also, of course, a book you can find on Amazon as well. So, Aaron, I'm going to ask a question here with folks, and you tell me if they give the right answer. So you need to go to that text box on our homepage to put in your answer. You need to put in your name and your location to qualify, and the first correct answer coming in will win. So we talked about five different ecosystems that exist in the coastal waters. Name three of them. Name three of those five coastal systems, ecosystems that we talked about tonight, and you'll win Aaron's book. So, Aaron, I've got a queue here. I'm waiting for these super fast typers that we have out there. Okay, I think we got one. He added something extra in there, but he says tides, grass, beaches, and salt marsh. Three of those are the ecosystems we talked about, aren't they, Aaron?
Yeah, everything but the tides.
everything but the tides. So we'll give you the extra credit, Trey Owens, on the tides, but you just won Aaron's book, The Orvis Guide to Fly Fishing for Coastal Gamefish, and I know you'll enjoy it and learn a lot. Trey's in Idaho, so he's going to have to ride his bicycle a long way to get down to that salt. But we all get down there now and again, and I'm sure Trey does too. So congratulations, Trey. Again, send me your mailing address so the publisher can get the book sent out to you, and you can either do it in that same text box you used tonight or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So congratulations, and Aaron, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. It was a pleasure to talk to you and learn more about coastal saltwater fishing, and I sure learned a lot, and I know everybody else did, so thanks a lot.
Sure, thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Our next broadcast will be on September 17th, and on that show we'll be interviewing Captain Dave Bitters, and our topic for the show will be stripers on the Massachusetts coast. Captain Dave Bitters guides for striped bass on Massachusetts coast, and we're going to learn the secrets of how to hook up with one of these most exciting East Coast sport fish. So join us then. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Flats Time Charters, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673 extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.